Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
One of the international themes we have featured a couple of times over the past 15 months broadcasting our podcast has been the issue of religion and religious liberty in China. Carrie Casel at the University of Oregon was one of our guests on two different occasions when we examined how the communist governments regulated churches and how these churches survived. These podcasts were also complemented recently by my interview with Lan Chu regarding the Catholic Church under another communist regime, Vietnam. Well, we turn once again to China and religion under communism in this episode. And now I'm returning to this topic because, well, first of all, China is a pretty big country that is exercising increasing influence in the world, and also because the whole notion of secularization theory is really being put to a test in this country and region of the world. If religion does indeed fade away or become less publicly salient as a nation modernizes, as secularization theorists would say, nowhere should this be more true than in China, a country that has seen rapid economic modernization in recent decades and has a government that is trying to best limit the growth and influence of religion in everyday life. But contrary to what the secularization theorist would suggest, religious belief and practice is expanding in China, not contracting. To explore what's going on in this landscape, both religiously and politically, I am pleased to be joined by a scholar who recently visited China to discuss the issue of religion and the rule of law with several different individuals. The scholar of whom I speak is Professor Kevin Cooney of Northwest University in Kirkland, Washington. Kevin is a professor of political science and business, having completed the postdoctoral bridge program in the Hoff Graduate School of Business of the Warrington College of Business Administration at the University of Florida. Thus, he brings an eye of an economist, not just a political scientist, to this topic as well. He's the author of Japan's Foreign Policy Maturation, A Quest for Normalcy, and has been the past president of Christians in Political Science. Kevin can also boast about having traveled to more than 50 nations around the world and has had the opportunity to teach at the university level in China. He recently returned from a trip there, and what he observed and discovered forms the basis of what we will talk about today. Kevin, welcome to Research on Religion.
Yes, thank you very much, Tony.
First, I got to ask, 50 countries. Okay, yes. Now I know China had to be the biggest country. What was the smallest country you were to?
Smallest country, that would be Luxembourg.
Luxembourg, okay. Yeah. So 50 countries. Are you going for all 190? You got a little flag, map in your office with all the pins in there?
I used to until the pins started falling out.
Oh,
but
okay.
I do plan on trying to increase that number. My goal is at least to get into triple digits.
All right. That's good for you. I'm pretty satisfied here at home, so that's all good. So let's go ahead and talk about your most recent trip to China. Now, one of the things that we were talking about before we started the recording of this podcast was that you had been to China 25 years earlier, almost 25 years to the day from when you took this trip back in, I think it was June or July of 2011. Give us a little bit of perspective of what was China like 25 years ago, socially, economically, politically, and what it's like today, and then we'll take that into the religion world.
Okay. When I arrived in China, this was 1986. I went there to teach English to graduate students who were prepping to take like the TOEFL exam in English so they could study in foreign universities, particularly in the United States or Great Britain. And it was a very different place. I taught in Lanzhou in the Gansu province, which is northwest central China.
Is that around by Beijing?
Oh, no. This is much further east or west in the country. It's right on the edge of the Gobi Desert.
Okay.
It's very high. It's about the height of the city of Denver, about a mile high. Very interesting. It's where basically kind of the Silk Road started. It's kind of an intersection of Muslim China, the Buddhist, the Confucian. All these things are intersecting, and this is a great trading city in the past. And what was interesting about China at that time was considered America's ally against the Soviet Union. This is part of the Nixon detente. This is the opening of China by Nixon, Henry Kissinger, making China the idea of helping China to capitalize and influence as a hedge against the Soviet Union and part of the whole grand encirclement strategy. China was just beginning under Deng Xiaoping at this time to modernize and to capitalize its economy. The one-child law had just been in effect for 2 years as they started trying to bring their population under control. There was a great optimism there. You saw Americans were seen as really great, like a European, like a Frenchman or a German or a Brit, okay, they were nice to meet. But if you were American, you were top notch. You were really hot stuff. And so it was one of those things that had a lot of attention. It was a great experience. But at the same time, it's coming out of the Cultural Revolution, which it ended in 76. But it's one of the, it was beginning to just get this feel for that openness. This idea of democracy was kind of brewing, but there was still that repressive fear that was going on. Mm-hmm. At that time, I taught at a university there. I wanted to visit a church, but I was told that it was too dangerous for me as a white Caucasian.
Okay, so let me stop you there, because you got an idea of 25 years ago, things are starting to open up in China a little bit. And now we're into the religion scene. And there's been a lot of talk about house church movements. We've, again, focused on that with Kerry Casel in a previous episode. We'll link back to that. So we get an idea that religion is flourishing today, but 25 years ago, 1985, 86, was there a religious scene there? You mentioned you couldn't visit a house church. You knew they kind of existed, but any idea how big that movement was?
My sense, having not visited myself, I got it secondhand from a fellow teacher that was there who was a Japanese American who did visit house church and actually visited one of the one single operating church that was a Christian church as part of the three self churches, which was the officially government sanctioned church, not sponsored but sanctioned, that was there. And he was able to go in there because he could blend in. He looks because he's Asian, Japanese American, he looks that way, where I stand out like a sore thumb there. So that was something. And he talked about what he experienced visiting these congregations. But even there, there was a lot of fear. His very presence there was very risky for them to be interacting in such a way with foreigners. So it was very careful. But there was a very vibrant Christian church that existed there. There at that time in China, there was a lot of Christian missionaries from the West who very actively smuggled in Bibles and religious literature into China, because you could not purchase a Bible in Chinese in China at this time. So that was something that was very much, that was the atmosphere that I was in China. So I went for my entire time that I taught there, with the exception of one time I attended a Catholic service in Beijing while waiting for a visa, that I was never able to go to a church service except with fellow Westerners when we just met together to have a worship service.
Well, the question about smuggling in a Bible is kind of interesting to me. Now, you're traveling there. You're an academic teaching English. Now, you're a pretty religious guy, so I know you travel around with your Bible a lot. Did you bring a Bible in?
Yes, but my Bible was in English, and also being an academic, I was going in there to teach. I was allowed to bring books in with me.
Okay, but they didn't go through your suitcase and say, whoa, Holy Bible, what is this thing?
No, they did not do that.
Because I'm just wondering, just on a kind of a micro level, how people can smuggle these things in. Do they stick them in their blue jeans or, I don't know.
That's kind of, that's what they do. They stick them all over. But you think about it. in any country smuggling things in. You can't search everybody.
Right.
And that's the thing, is that's how smuggling works, is they don't search everybody. They look for things that are more likely. There's different things that go on. There's actually one of the most common ways of smuggling things is actually through the mail.
Oh.
And that's actually one of those things that they actually will do. And often one of the tactics back then was they would smuggle them into the country, and then they would just mail them internally, domestically in the country, the Bibles and the religious literature.
Wow. Well, that's kind of interesting. Just the logistics of that and thinking through mm-hmm. that is pretty amazing unto itself. So that was 25 years ago. There's something going on there. We see religious activity. You get a sense for it, but as a foreigner, you're not allowed to sniff around there. Now, just a few months ago, and again, we're recording this in mid to late August here in 2011. Your trip there was in July of 2011 for a two-week trip there to China. Tell us a little bit first about what that trip is, and then we'll reflect upon how it was different than 25 years ago. So why were you there a couple months ago?
Okay, but this was a sponsored seminar that was sponsored by the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, the Nigel Institute out of Calvin College, and the Plowshares Foundation that sponsored a study of the religion and the rule of law. The subtext was in China, but that was not officially on the program or brochure. But the thing is, that was the focus, and basically was the case study that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of eight North American scholars that was invited to participate in this program after going through an application process. From what I heard, there was over 200 applicants, and I was one of the lucky eight that were chosen.
Wow. Okay.
Then there were supposed to be a number of Chinese scholars that were joining us. We ended up with 10 Chinese scholars, 2 Chinese graduate students. There were supposed to be more Chinese scholars, but given the current political climate and crackdown on Christian churches in China, several of the Chinese scholars chose at the last moment to back out of the seminar and did not want to participate.
So by seminar, you're talking we all get together every day, sit around in a conference room and talk about different themes or issues related to the main theme, which was religion and the rule of law.
A little bit like that. We all started off, both the Chinese scholars and the American scholars, having a set of readings that were provided for us, looking at the history of religion in China, different writings on the status of it by different Chinese scholars, for the most part, some Western scholars as well, so to kind of get us all started on the same page. Then what we did when we got there, we spent some time, the North American scholars, we got to know each other, and then we were joined by our Chinese colleagues, who then we got to know, and we did various exercises that kind of looked at some case studies, we discussed them and what have you, and then we started bringing in some speakers, some experts from the Social Sciences Academy in Shanghai, the different theological schools that do exist in China that are part of the Three Selves Church and officially sanctioned.
Mm-hmm.
We also then went to visit some churches, and we visited the main church in Shanghai where a lot of foreigners, it dates back to the colonial era.
And that's the officially sanctioned one, part of this
Three Self Churches.
Right.
And that we visited the Three Self Churches, have their headquarters in Shanghai, also the Council of Chinese Churches, the Triple C as we called it, they have their headquarters. There's also a basically equivalent of a nonprofit aid group that's sponsored by the churches as well. And what we would do is we take these field trips out to visit these churches, these organizations, see how they function, see all the what their activities. We talk with the heads of these groups. We ask them questions, and they would talk about what their experience. And one of the interesting things that clarify this, that the Three Self Church is not a state-sponsored church.
Okay.
It is a state-sanctioned church.
What's the difference between a state-sponsored church and a state-sanctioned church?
A state-sponsored church means they get their funding from the government, and the ministers are government employees. A state-sanctioned church means that the government permits them to exist, but they have no support from the government. The church exists completely on the donations of the congregations.
But that the government says, hey, we know you exist, you can operate in a very recognizable building, and you got your clergy, that's all fine.
Yes.
Okay. Are there any state-sponsored churches in China?
The closest thing that would get there is this is very much in recent years, and this is one of the things, because we didn't just look at Christianity, we also looked at Buddhism and Taoism, and you got Tibetan Buddhism and different in Islam and what have you. But in the minority groups, because you also have so many minority religion and groups that are part of the cultural identity of these minority groups, not just the Han Chinese, which make up over 90% of Chinese, but you have the dozens of smaller minority groups that exist on the periphery of China.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, when we get down to these Chinese churches and that they're being sponsored, or not sponsored, sanctioned by the government, the question is, whether the government actually controls who's in the leadership, who's in the position. And the thing is, while they make them self-supporting and self-funding, they still have that idea that they have the blessing of the government to exist and who's heading them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the issues within China, is the Catholic Church has refused to subscribe to this. And this is one of the interesting things, that they say it's the blessing of the Pope,
mm-hmm.
from basically St. Peter's heir in Rome, who can anoint the bishops. In their words, the Chinese government says, no, the Chinese Catholic Church is totally independent, and we can appoint the bishops,
mm-hmm.
not the Pope. And so there's this tension that's going on between the Catholic Church, because in China there are basically five recognized religions: Protestantism, Catholicism, which is considered a cult, not a Christian religion, by the Chinese government, is defined, and part of this is its punishment for refusing the authority of Beijing on the bishops issue, which is a very separate issue. You have Buddhism, Islam, and Taoism.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the five main sanctioned religions. So Mormonism is not sanctioned. You cannot have a Jehovah's Witness. Those are other ones that you might recognize here in America that are would not be recognized. And then you go into one of the other things. Hinduism is not recognized yet. It's one of the world's major religions.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism is not recognized either, even though they have a history in China that goes far back, almost two millennia, to the Great Dispersia,
mm-hmm.
after 70 AD. So it's very interesting to see what's officially sanctioned and what's allowed in there, but also how much the government controls in there. And so this is where that's the foggy thing that we were kind of looking at and investigating in this whole seminar, because we were really there to learn and to discuss what we were learning. And so we would usually go out in the mornings, we would see something, visit some place, what have you, interact with a religious group or organization, and then we would come back in the afternoons, we would kind of have a debriefing, we'd talk among ourselves what we were learning about this whole experience.
In addition to the, you said about 10 or 12 academics who were normally with your group, you had a few people coming to visit, were there any government officials that were sitting in on this?
No government officials per se.
Okay.
On it.
Yeah.
So we did have an official travel agency that was posted, that got the bus that we would take or guide us to what we were doing. They were less interested in what we were discussing, but mm-hmm. they were with us. But I did not have any feeling that they were our government minders or anything
right.
like that.
Okay.
China's a very big country, and as some people think of the monolith of a communist country, it is very hard, as one Chinese scholar put it, to keep track of 1.4 billion people.
Yeah.
And then try to keep track of all the foreigners that are coming in and out of China. It's an impossible task.
Yeah, I have problems keeping track of 25 students in my own classes. So, yeah, I guess 1.5 billion would be a little bit difficult to do. The title, now you made a point about this when we were talking about this before our podcast began, that this was called a program or a seminar on religion and the rule of law in China, and not religion and religious liberty in China. Now, why is that? Because when you and I were talking a couple months ago, you had mentioned this to me, so I'm going to go off and we're going to look at religious liberty in China. And I said, oh, okay, that's what you're doing. But it really was religion and the rule of law. So why was it called that? And what's the big difference between rule of law and religious liberty?
Well, part of the way it was described was to make sure that we had permission to go in. This was, we had the seminar that we conducted had sanction that was granted for us to conduct it in China about 4 years ago. It's doubtful that if we had applied for it today that it would have been granted permission to conduct such a seminar in the current climate. But the idea of having the religion in the rule of law really was to take a look at what is the role of religion? Is it a human right? Is this something that we are able to function in that is part of any society? And the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights grants religious freedom as a human right. And most democratic constitutions around the world do grant that, including what is very fundamental to this is that right to change religions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that's much of a attention on a separate issue with the Islamic world on it. But the thing is, in China was this idea of having that it's a freedom of thought, a freedom of expression, but the challenge to secular government is what religion can do and does do in most cases is create a hierarchy that an authority that is greater than government.
Mm-hmm.
And in China, this is a threat to the Communist Party's authority because they sit there as a supreme authority, yet they have a large number of their citizens who actually claim allegiance to a higher authority. Now, in most countries, like in America, this is not a direct confrontation between the people and the government. Mm-hmm. They believe that God, to use the Christian terminology, tells them to be good, to give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. That means obey the laws of the land, but also obey the laws of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's a simple, straightforward. But China is right now in the midst of this extreme fear within the Chinese Communist Party that there might be a jasmine spring.
What do you mean by jasmine spring?
Well, as we've witnessed throughout the Arab world, we've had this Arab Spring, which mm-hmm. takes its name from the Prague Spring of the 1960s and the uprising there, but this uprising towards democracy. People taking to the streets and demanding democracy and in essence, the overthrow of dictatorial regimes. Egypt had it. We're watching the Libya in its last throes. You see it in Syria. You see it in Tunisia, where it all got started. China fears this, and they've really been cracking down on social networks. If I wanted to check my Facebook account, I would need to get a special software patch that allows me to access Facebook through the Great Firewall.
Mm.
I could not access, and I tried just to log onto my Facebook account while I was in China. Would not allow me to do that. Social networking is stopped.
I just got to stop you there and ask you, when you were checking if you could get to Facebook, you obviously checked out the Research on Religion Facebook page that we do have, right? Or did you not? Because I'm sure all
of them tried to look at it.
Okay,
it
all right.
Get me anything that had Facebook.com.
Okay.
No way.
it's just my reminder that to our listeners, we are on Facebook. And if you're not in China, please do log on to us and keep up for updates. You can check it out on our website. But okay, so they're afraid of this social media and this jasmine spring where there's an uprising. We've seen that, dating back to Tiananmen Square. And even before then, there were several other protests I know from my Chinese history courses. And I guess what you said, too, is really interesting. The rendering to Caesar, the thing there, Caesar's, and to God, that is God. Now, the Chinese Communist Party is officially atheist. So when they talk about rendering unto Caesar, the things are Caesar, there's a period there. There's not a comma that says, and unto God. And so I can see how that is going to become a problem for them, saying, well, we don't recognize the second half of that sentence, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is they don't want the divided loyalty. They want the absolute loyalty to the state on that. And but at the same time, they actually do see a little bit, they're beginning to see some value of religion, because like after the great Sichuan earthquake, actually it was...
Which was when?
2 years ago now.
Okay.
I'm trying to think on it. Just within the last couple of years, I mean, they've had several earthquakes there in China, but this was one of the bad ones, that it... that some Christian church groups were the first on the scene rendering aid and giving aid there, and they suddenly see a value in nonprofit groups, and that actually adds value to society to actually have people working in groups and doing these things, that government can encompass this all. So this is one of the contradictions that they've suddenly said, oh, charitable nonprofits are actually doing a good job. They're actually doing it better than we are, because the Chinese government got criticized for being so slow initially in reacting to this, and part of the great humanitarian disaster was actually shoddy government standards and enforcement of them on building codes and what have you, because some of the notable things were some school collapses and things like that.
We just talked with Lan Chu on the Catholic Church in Vietnam, and a very similar attitude is being expressed by the government. That's like, well, we want to control these churches, but oh, wait a minute. They're actually good at providing a lot of social services that we currently can't, because we don't have the resources, or we want to devote the resources elsewhere. And on top of it, and I've seen this in Latin America as well, the governments like this when these nonprofit groups or these churches come in and take the load off a lot of what they're doing, especially if it's effective, because after an earthquake, and we see this throughout history, that if the government doesn't step in and do a good job, it's not surprising you're to see an uprising. People are very upset because now, you know, the pedal's down to the metal, and you can see that your government's not effective, so people get upset. But if these groups come in and take care of everything, population happy, yeah, okay, that's good. Maybe these churches do provide some benefit. But as you say, they want to give them a leash, a longer leash to be on to do this, but a leash nonetheless.
Yeah, and this is exactly what they're doing in China, and they're providing these social services. In fact, actually, many of our Chinese colleagues are actually who came from sociology or anthropology that were part of this seminar actually were working with Chinese minority groups who are part of this huge wave of immigration to the cities looking for work. And this is one of the interesting things when you get to the political economic aspect of China, is you have this China that is Shanghai, that is Beijing, skyscrapers everywhere, building up cars, air pollution, all the trappings of modern society and everything like that. But then you also have the China that has been left behind in this modernization process that is trying to catch up. And you have these, basically the equivalent of illegal migration, because you in China, you cannot move from place to place without having a permit. You can't just pack up from your rural farm and just head into Shanghai and find a place to live, and if you can find a job, great, like you can here in the United States. You have to have a permit, but you get basically a lot of illegal migrant laborers who come into the cities to work in the factories, work in these, some would say sweatshops, depends on what there it is, and that's a whole other topic that goes beyond this conversation, but they come there. But the thing is, many of these are also minority groups. And the thing is, now they're cut off from their support network where they exist in an enclave in a different part of China among their own people with their own language, their own culture, and customs. Now they're here. They're bringing that in. And so one of the things is that interaction and the study between these people and the clashing in there, that actually some of these church groups are actually providing some social stability for them and giving them an outlet for them to practice their own cultural beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about church groups, I'm also talking in a very large and area, but just in that aspect of that social ability of we are providing a service, like maybe the Salvation Army might take in any homeless off the street, no matter what their color or creed, because these are people who are in need. Mm-hmm. They're providing the structure there. And so that's an important thing to do because China has not been able to stop this.
Yeah.
They can't stop it. It's just, it's occurring. You've got growing shanty towns. You got the whole thing of this growing up around all these new cities where there are the jobs.
And I can imagine from the government's perspective, this is an interesting choice for them because they see these illegal immigrants coming into town, these mm-hmm. migrant workers coming into town, and setting up these shanty towns. And that could be a place of a lot of social unrest. Mm-hmm. And so how do you deal with it? Well, you have these churches. Now, you know, some of it might be provided by the officially sanctioned church, but I'm guessing a lot of it's provided by these quote-unquote underground house churches as well. So it seems like the government's in this quandary. It's like, well, you don't want the social unrest, so let's turn to the churches, these underground churches as well. But, well, we don't like these underground churches as well. So it's kind of an interesting juggling act they have to perform there.
Oh, yes, most definitely. And it's all about the idea of control. Mm-hmm. And that fear of that loss of control. See, this happened in the Arab Spring was there was a loss of control.
Yeah.
And the thing is, China wants to maintain control. They have loosened the reins economically so that people can make money. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's realization that one of the things that actually surprised me, even as a business professor who's paid attention to China, is I did not realize that a lot of these Chinese companies and corporations are actually still under government control. It's basically just these are subsidiaries that are operating it. There are many American firms that think they're dealing with a private Chinese entity. They're actually dealing with a subsidiary of a larger state-owned, mm-hmm. controlled firm that's operating under capitalist principles. In fact, over 90% of all businesses and companies operating in China are subsidiaries of state-controlled firms.
Yeah.
So, and that was an amazing statistic. So it shows you there's still, even with this huge capitalist explosion in China, they've given a lot of free rein to the managers to make money and to profit from that themselves personally.
Mm-hmm.
But they had still, in the end, the stockholders, the board of directors and things are controlled by the state and i.e. the Communist Party.
Let me ask you about this now that you talked about the explosion of capitalism and the changes that have been going on, people coming from the countryside into the city to find work, the rising skyscrapers and stuff. You were there 25 years ago. You came back 25 years later. And again, with an acute sense of what the religious landscape is, because you're very much in tune with that, what changes have you seen from 25 years ago to today in terms of the religious landscape?
The religious landscape is actually much more free.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that during the Cultural Revolution, to go back even before I was in China, religion was eliminated. Churches were closed, temples were closed for Buddhism. I mean, mosques were closed. Everything was just, everything was cut off.
And this was then, the 1960s up through 76.
Yes. And then in the late 70s, China reversed itself and allowed the establishment of the three self-churches, allowed the reopening of temples and mosques, and it began slowly there. So I arrive in 86, and it just, you've got them just coming out of this period where they were hunted down and everything was underground, mm-hmm. to the point they're opening up. Now they've had this huge economic freedom wave. I mean, you have to think from 86 to 89, you have Tiananmen Square.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see things brewing there. In fact, if I left China in July of 86. In December of 86, 87, there was a few protests in Tiananmen Square at the time, and there was kind of settled down. But they were a precursor to the 89 protests that resulted in the crackdown. The thing is, that was all occurring, but the thing is, what China basically did right after Tiananmen Square said, okay, we're really going to unleash the freedoms of the market and economy, and there was money to be made. So you can either protest for and hunger strike for democracy, or you can go out and get rich.
Mm-hmm.
Many people have chosen to get rich. And that was the kind of the deal they made. But at the same time, you got this idea that there is a level, and we could talk about, I mean, different scholars have studied this idea of this yearning for something greater than oneself, mm-hmm. that money doesn't necessarily offer all this. And there's a lot of sociological and psychological studies that back this up. But the thing is, China tried to control the space for the church or religion in China, that they allow, okay, this church can exist. It has, for example, I was telling you earlier about this one church we visited in Shanghai, had about 600 to 700 seats in their church, but had 9,000 members, but they was only allowed to do two services on a Sunday.
So that's 1,400 members they can pack in there. They have 9,000, so either people are standing on top of one another, or what else might be going on?
They do closed-circuit television to other parts of the building. They have a huge lawn where people will be out there, rain or shine. To listen, I mean, it was interesting. We arrived at the church to visit, and we sat in the visitor's gallery where they had some headphones for us to listen in on. But we were there about a little bit over an hour ahead of time. There was not a seat to be found in the church with 50 minutes before the service.
Wow.
And so you see the thing, you have to come early if you want a seat.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, but what China is doing is they're controlling the space. But the thing is, what they're forgetting about is this, the law of supply and demand. Now, the law of supply and demand is a really interesting, because we think about it mostly in economic terms, but it really is the closest thing we have, our humans, to a natural law where you can pretty much dictate behavior. If people want something, they're going to go for it. And what China has done by limiting the space, they've increased the demand elsewhere, and has actually fed into this house church movement that's been occurring. And if I may even just go into it, just talk about it, is that there is just an incredible house church movement. We had a lot of discussions about just how big is this house church movement. Mm-hmm. And we had numbers ranging like 20 million to 110 million.
Big range. Yeah.
Yes. And the thing is, the arguments, and the interesting thing was, when we visited the American embassy and talked with the person who studies domestic affairs for the U.S. government in Beijing, and she was talking about how they said every estimate that she has seen by far underestimates the size of the house church movement in China.
Wow.
The thing is, I'm thinking, I mean, the larger the number, which was greeted very skeptically by the officials from the Three Self Church, is actually, and it would appear to me, based on my experience, is a much more likely figure. So if you think about it, if I'm talking 110, you're talking about 8 to 9, maybe 10% of China's Christian.
Wow.
And that causes people to draw back and say, no, that can't be true.
Yeah.
That's not China. Well, what do we know? Because one of the things is, how do you take a census?
Right, you can't.
I mean, you can ask quietly, okay, but the thing is, as we all know as social scientists, I mean, if people don't trust the surveyor or the questioner, the anonymity, they're not going to answer to it, truthfully.
Right.
And that's the fear atmosphere. Exists differently in different places.
Which, in many ways, it's very ironic for the government, right? They're worried about this growing underground movement that could potentially threaten their own sovereignty. They're worried about these people paying homage to another source of authority, to God. And yet, they keep it underground where they can't actually see it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and to try to get a good measure for it makes it very difficult. One of the other things that you said about that supply and demand type of issue, too, we talk about this in terms of black markets, right? That if people really do want vegetables or automobiles or blue jeans, whatever it might be, they're willing to pay that extra price to do that. And as you say, they've capped the official church level, the three selves churches, at a certain level. But then you see people willing to go to church an hour before the service starts to get a seat. I mean, which for us here in the United States, that's pretty amazing. I mean, I go to a church where people roll in 5 minutes late to church because they were busy getting a coffee, right? But there to go an hour ahead of time is really saying something that the demand is high. There are people really, really want this kind of thing. And if that is still visible in this church that you visit, and it spills out on the lawn, it's visible, you can only imagine that it's creeping into all the other different social crevices around the country as well.
Yes, and it's amazing. So one of the interesting things I actually noticed in the official church was how young the congregation was. This was not old
okay,
people.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when you go out into the house churches, which was something I was able to do on this trip that I was not able to do 25 years ago, you see even a younger crowd.
Really?
They're intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
They are the rising middle class in China. I mean, at least the ones that I was able to visit, and I know from the conversation that there's a lot more mm-hmm. out there.
And that goes, that's an interesting statement about the sociology of religion, too. I was going to ask you about that, what the demographics that you observed in this house church movement would be, because typically we, old line sociologists towing the secularization theory line say, yeah, you know, religion, that's for the poor folks. Right, and that's for older folks that are about to, you know, die, and they're looking for something at the end. You know, kids don't go to church, and youthful. But you're seeing the exact opposite. That it's pretty young, and it tends to be middle class or wealthier individuals. And it goes again along with what you said too. That the government says, well, here's some capitalism. Go make a lot of money. Don't bother us. Let us rule over the country. But then these folks see that there's something more, right? There's got to be something else other than buying another car. And that's, I think, what's going on.
And what's amazing about this is these are the ones with the most to lose.
Yeah.
Because they have made the money. They have assets
mm-hmm.
that the government can take away from them. And this is an example with what probably maybe some of the listeners out there have heard about the Shouwang Church in Beijing.
And tell us about that.
Yeah. This is actually was very interesting. It popped up in our conversations repeatedly with both the Three Self Church officials and even with the house churches, because it's even controversial within the house church movement. The Shouwang Church, just to give a little quick background on it, was basically a, quote, house church, but in name only. It evolved from a series of churches that were meeting in like small cell groups in people's homes into a really public church that was several thousand strong, that was meeting in like a storefront that was regular. It was not very hidden. The government was doing that. So the thing is, it was really a big entity that was going. And then with this Arab Spring and the government seeing that, well, this church is a little bit too big and too public, we're going to go to their landlord and basically have them cancel the lease and change the locks and deny them their space. And this is the important thing, is looking at this idea of having space to gather, having the mm-hmm. space to worship. And the church was faced with a choice. Okay, now we can all just kind of collapse into our small little cell groups and scatter out and not see each other at all very regularly and just be in small little groups, or we can take a stand. Now, a lot of the house church leaders felt they should have just done the quiet thing, because we don't want to draw too much attention to ourselves and risk a true government crackdown on us.
Mm-hmm. I can see the reasoning behind that as well. And again, it's somewhat paradoxical for the government. You're going to try to put your hand down on top of this church and hopefully make it go away. But as we can see, a lot of people are investing a lot of money into this. I mean, this is costly to go to these churches. It's risky, it's costly. So people are really willing to take a stand on this. So if you squish this thing, it can spread out into the smaller house churches, which, you know, at some point in time, I'm thinking kind of like little mercury pellets when you break a thermometer. Mm-hmm. It scatters, but eventually they start to come back together into a big, huge blob. So from the side of the Shouwang Church leaders, one side of me would say, yeah, let's go ahead and scatter once again, and in 2 years we'll come back and meet. But you say that they could take a stand too, right?
And they wanted that stand was the idea is that we have a right to get together and worship. They're not talking government. They're not talking democracy. They're not talking about changing the government. All they're talking about is wanting to worship together. And the Shouwang Church was so public that a couple of the organizers that were from the Plowshares Institute had attended the Shouwang Church pre-crackdown. And basically what they did, since they were denied a space to worship in, they decided, okay, we're going to just assemble in the public park, and we're going to meet there. Well, Beijing weather that works maybe in the late spring and summer, but it does, I mean, it gets cold in the winter. It wasn't going to work year-round. I mean, the government could have just kind of ignored it for a while, whatever. But no, they came and prevented them from doing it. So they started trying to do through, like, text messaging, okay, we're going to meet here.
Oh, like a flash mob kind
of
thing.
Yeah, flash mob type thing. Well, the government gets tapped into this, and they're there just as quick, and they're arresting, and there's quite a few, I guess several hundred that are now under house arrest. They're not putting them in the main jails or what have you, but they're putting them under house arrest and just preventing them, the pastors of the church. They're not allowed to go out, minister to the congregants, to go do things in public. They're just kind of locked in their houses and the police are watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something, and it's all over this idea, do we have a right to worship?
Mm-hmm.
And that takes us back to the whole day, the human rights and what we're looking at, the rule of law, because that is also one of the big troubles that China is having, and this gets into, the economic issues. You have this idea of copyright and intellectual property and those sort of things that China is running constantly in the province. The idea is China going to follow the rule of law for a corporation coming in? For example, one of the things that many of your listeners might have heard of is Apple. They have these Apple stores. Many of you probably people have been to these Apple stores, and you can see your iPads and your iMacs and what have you. Well, they had the big one that I saw actually in Shanghai was an official Apple store. Well, in some of other cities, there were these Apple stores where right down to the employees thought they were working for Steve Jobs in California. But the thing is, they weren't. They were basically completely a pirated store. And that thing is because there wasn't a respect for the idea of copyright and intellectual property and what have you. And this is the thing is, China officially allows freedom of religion.
Right.
But it's out. But when you start allowing these things, it gets out of your control. And the thing is, are they truly going to have the rule of law?
Yeah, when you start tinkering with it arbitrarily, that's when you lose the rule of law. You have one set of rules on the books, but in a basketball game that the referees are favoring one side, they don't call fouls on one side, they call a lot more fouls on the other. And, you know, eventually people say this isn't the game that we're playing. And it's interesting for me, and this fascinates me throughout history, when it comes to dictatorships worrying about this kind of stuff. And I'm gonna get your take on this, because when you talk about them cracking down the Shouan church, that it's just some people meeting, they're sitting there worshiping, they're singing some songs for an hour or two on a Sunday morning, no big deal, right? That does not seem threatening. The same thing with Falun Gong, when they get together in a big public space, it looks like a giant yoga club. And so but they go down and crack down on this. But in cracking down, for me, it seems the downside for the regime is bigger than just letting the thing run, because you crack down on this, then you draw attention to the fact that you're not following the rule of law. You draw attention to the fact that maybe you cannot no longer trust your government, and it almost seems like it's setting little sparks into a powder keg, whereas if you say, hey, you know, just you go ahead and worship, that's not that big a deal. I don't see this thing exploding into a big, huge anti-communist party rally or anything. Maybe they think that way. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
In many ways, what they're basically doing by denying the space is they're increasing the value of the space.
Right. Yeah.
That's where that market, supply and demand. And suddenly more people want what you tell them you can't have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's that whole thing of just saying, you can't have this. Oh, it makes you want it more.
Mm-hmm.
And in China, I think that's one of those things that's actually is created really a demand for religion. Because why does the government not want us to have this?
Yeah.
Why can't we have this?
I think in the aspect, too, of the martyrdom, and not all the way to the folk, to the point where they're being fed by lions, but that there are people who are willing to, once the church is shut down, to show up at the local park, knowing that full well that there are going to be police officers coming and looking at them. People who are walking by saying, whoa, these folks are risking a lot in order to go to church. There must be something really good about that church. And in many ways, it might be fueling more curiosity on the part of other people who might not go to the show on church, right? Because that's been squashed, but find one of these smaller house churches down the block or something.
Yeah, and that's exactly what did. I mean, originally on the plan and the schedule was we were going to visit the show on church because, mm-hmm. an example of, quote, almost, it was kind of considered almost a semi-officially sanctioned, unofficial church because of its size and public stature. Well, because of the crackdown, that was scuttled. We didn't get anywhere mm-hmm. near that. In fact, actually put on the schedule was actually visiting a church that George Bush and Condi Rice and Obama and Hillary Clinton and whenever they all go mm-hmm. to Beijing, that's where they go to church and put a face on attending a church in China. But the thing is, the smaller churches are there, and they're organized around all sorts of things, the commonalities of work, mm-hmm. the commonalities of location, all those little things that gather people together, and they exist, and they find the space.
Mm-hmm.
And you see a vibrant community, and that's one of the things that just surprised me, is I saw a life
mm-hmm.
that was just so vibrant, and just, to me, it was just, as a Christian and a person of faith myself, it was like you see the person on the street who's going through that motions, I'm going back to the Simon and Garfunkel song about people walking without thinking, people like not even getting the words right, but it was a song, but just kind of that thing about modern society, just people moving past each other, mm-hmm. what have you, but you get into these little spaces, and this is where people feel they have purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And God loves them. God cares about them. That this is something there, and they have a joy that's amazing. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, we went out after church with some of the people from the congregation, and we went out to a restaurant and what have you. So come time to eat, go to say a prayer. Well, what did they say it in? English. It was interesting because the restaurant people couldn't understand the English. Of course, there's just enough scattered foreigners. It gives them a perfect excuse to be speaking in English,
and there's
the bypassing of it. But the thing is, it was the way the expression, and it existed on the side there, was just such a fascinating thing. And the efforts that they put into it, I mean, even the Three Self Church, actually, they receive... They have to support themselves, and that isn't a problem. The finances for supporting Chinese give to the church.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting too. We were discussing this before the interview as well. The issue, and I made the statement that, you know, China being relatively poor, I mean compared to the United States, but as you mentioned, it's becoming a wealthy society rather quickly. There's a growing middle class. There's a growing wealthy class as well. And they're pouring this money into the churches. As you mentioned, the other church that you went to had closed circuit television and broadcasting to other places. And that, you know, is no small endeavor. I mean, we think of that just kind of automatically happens. No, people have to go buy this equipment in an economy that's, you know, more tightly controlled than here in the United States. They have to find people to put this kind of stuff up, thinking that it's going to be around for quite a while. And you're taking a big risk in doing all these things. So, again, it really shows at one level you say, oh, that's nice. They got speakers and closed circuit television. But it really shows the depth of commitment and faith in China more than any other kind of survey instrument might be able to tell you.
Yes, that's most definitely. They are committed. And in the end, what it really comes down to, well, not every house church member would be willing to sacrifice it all.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those whom I met, they were willing.
Mm-hmm.
Their attitude sort of thing is, this is something that's important to them, and they are going to commit to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, but they also are, it was interesting to see almost the generational differences that were also there among the house church members, the younger ones, were a lot more cocky, less cautious, which, mm-hmm. I mean...
Yeah, you're 20 years old. You're allowed to do that. Of course you are.
As I mentioned, like it says, well, it's trying to keep track of 1.4 billion people. It's hard.
Yeah.
Whereas an older person was like, okay, when we want to go to this one house church, well, let's only enter the building two at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And let's space ourselves out by about 5-10 minutes, different things like that. There was a group of, I think, seven of us, and so we went in four groups and we spread out. It was interesting how to do it. Whereas another guy, just go in. They can't keep track of everybody, and this is a modern subdivision. It's interesting just to see how they react and do things and what have you. And we were being very cautious and very conscientious of our Chinese hosts that were there, that we didn't want to get them in trouble, and what we did. So we followed their lead in everything, and they were taking certain risks, and I realized it, because many of them, particularly the scholars that we associated, and those that had like positions of respect, could lose all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was something that's an amazing thing to do when you think about it, is that risk is how many people in the West, and when we say the West, like North America or Europe and stuff, would be willing to lose their homes and their jobs or the means of income.
Yeah. It's a interesting test of faith. We just had a sermon on this in our own church this past Sunday of how far are you willing to go and to give up the comfort in order to follow Christ. And, you know, for us sitting in the pews, it was in large measure just an academic discussion, right? It's an intellectual enterprise saying, oh, yeah, I guess I could give up this or that or the other thing. But, yeah, in a place like China, you're really putting it all on the line. So it really is a testament. Not only is this, you know, and I've heard some scholars saying, well, this is just kind of a fad going through China and such and such. Well, it seems a lot deeper. It seems more deeply rooted.
And I will say, I mean, going back 25 years, the church existed there.
Mm-hmm.
During the entire Cultural Revolution, it is estimated conservatively that the church doubled in size.
Wow. And that's the persecution era, right? That's, you know, when you're thinking about
that's
Nero's
correct,
persecution in Rome or the Decian persecution. That's what it was in China. And again, it's one of these fascinating things, is that the more you clamp down on a movement like this, the more it seems to flourish. So why don't dictators ever learn?
Yes. You know? In many ways, you take a look at where is Christianity the weakest. You take a look at, say, places where you have the most affluence.
Yeah.
And the thing is, where they're distracted by, I think there's no limits on what you can do, to the point that everybody's almost creating their own, as Bella described it, the Sheilaism, the fact that it's just people just create their own religion, named after this woman, Sheila, who basically had this religion she created all around herself, a little Buddhism, a little Hinduism, a little Hare Krishna, a little Christianity, a little something, and put it all together, and that's what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you have that. But the thing is, there was a little bit of a whole lot, but no commitment to anything.
Yeah.
And this was another interesting thing, is that was constantly that I saw, was one of the significant divides between the sanctioned church by the state and the house church movement, was the sanctioned church was saying, well, these house churches don't have good doctrine. They don't have training. They don't have anything. Nobody's teaching them how to study the Old Testament and New Testament.
They don't have a Yale Divinity School.
Yes, and that's the whole thing on that. But in the sermons I heard in these house churches, these were good, solid sermons that were doctrinally solid within the broad scope of Christianity that would just count. I mean, they weren't like super fundamentalist, conservative, or radical, or what. They were good, solid teachings that you could present at almost any denominational church in the United States. They were talking about the Bible, God's love, the need for salvation, all those things. They were good, solid sermons. And the sermons that we heard in the Three Selves Church were just as solid.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I, at some point in time, I got to do a podcast on divinity schools and wonder what their true purpose is. Now, I know we have a number of divinity school listeners. I'm not knocking you specifically, but just in general. Let me go back to something, and a little bit of a paradox in what you said. And I don't know how to wrap my head around this either, but you noticed when we were talking about Robert Bella's Sheilaism that we were talking about how places where you have a lot of affluence, that's where the church tends to be weakest. Yet, we also observed in China the church is really flourishing among the middle class and the wealthy. So, I mean, in one aspect, in a developing country where there's a lot of risk to be taken, you do have the wealthy really getting into religion strongly, deeply, fervently, but compared to the United States where you have more Sheilaism. Do you see that paradox there? How would you address that?
The interesting thing in China is it's something that's denied.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing is, you talk about the persecution of the seized churches, something is like, when someone tells you you're not supposed to, it's like, do this. It's like, I recall one time when I was a high schooler, we were on some field trip someplace or whatever, and suddenly the teacher yells, "Don't look." So what does everybody in the class
do? Turn your head.
Turn exactly where he's in, not to look. Okay, there was a streaker running across the street or whatever. It was one of these funny things. It's just that reaction is that we have that innate thing to say, no, yeah. we want to do. We want to check this out for ourselves. And the thing is, we find that we have our meaning because one of the things, I know I studied Japanese politics and what have you, and there's, I'm trying to remember the name of this Japanese poet, but he wrote Sorikara, which means like, from here, where do we go? And he talks about where is the modern person the most alone in life? Mm-hmm. And the modern person, in his case, he was writing right after the turn of the 20th century, was on the streetcar. Today it would be on the bus or on the subway, surrounded by people, packed in, yet they're the most alone because they lack their identity and what have you, and they're looking for meaning beyond this idea, this 9-to-5 job and what have you, and the purpose in life that Christ gives them. And that's something that is, I think I can see within China in the churches, they're seeing the meaning and the purpose, this desire to help people out. In a country where they aren't even allowing private nonprofits to function in the form of A groups, they were the first ones on the ground. Yet they aren't officially sanctioned or exist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're there helping out because they see a need and they're springing up. And that was the surprise to the Chinese government. It's like, ooh, and we actually do need these.
Yeah, yeah.
And we talked about it. So the thing is, it's just reaching out. But the thing is, this caring for your fellow man, they're doing good. And the thing is, in my mind, it does make no sense that the government does these things. But you take a look at a lot of the mindless actions throughout history. Do they make any sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll take Hitler's in the Holocaust and the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it have been a lot better if he wanted to conquer the world to have had the Jews, the German Jews on his side?
Don't destroy a huge portion of your population.
Especially some of the intellectual class that a lot of the Jews represented.
Yeah.
Think if he'd had Einstein in Germany instead of Einstein seeing the handwriting on the wall, hightailing it out of Germany and end up in the United States and helping us with our Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you take a look at these things and what have you, it doesn't make sense. But these are things that I'm very grateful for history's sake that Hitler did make the mistake, not in the sense of what happened to the Jews, but in the sense that for everybody there, that he didn't conquer the world.
Right, right.
And that's the thing. But you take a look at people, that dictators do make mistakes.
They crack down when they shouldn't, which seems absolutely irrational.
It's all about this desire for control and controlling how people think, and that idea, that innate thing that people have this desire, and it gets back to our human rights and the desire and the freedom that people want to express. I mean, one of the most fundamental things, in democracy is the idea that free expression.
Mm-hmm.
What is more free expression than religion? And the thing is, look at it. If you and I can sit down and talk and about religion, something that determines, quote, our eternal destiny, whether I'm a Christian and you're a Buddhist or Mormon or whatever, the thing is, and we can talk across it and we can have a civilized conversation about it, can't we then talk about the more temporal thing of who do we want in the White House or in Parliament or Congress and all the other government offices. And the thing is, if you allow that freedom, it is so fundamental to democracy, is actually having that. And I've done these studies, and I haven't done much, but I know there's some studies that have looked at it. Samuel Huntington looked at it in the third wave of democratization, was the idea of countries that actually do have religious freedom are the successful democracies. And there you get also then the some of the roots probably in the Chinese communist government, the fear, because the Chinese Communist Party realizes that if there came a democracy, they might lose their control and power.
Yeah.
And that idea is allowing that free flow of ideas. And that's the thing is, okay, we got to control this. And then there you start seeing the rationale behind it. And
it's kind of a
wrong, as short-sighted as it is, you can see the rationale.
The short-sightedness, I was about to say that. It's more of a short-term thinking. Let's try to keep the Pandora's box closed as much as we can, even though it's bursting. In the long run, it's going to burst, but you know, I'm only worried about the next 5 or 10 minutes here. You know, my own personal career and control and power and the like. We'll finish up with this, and I always give my guests on Research on Religion the chance to do a little bit of speculation. And you talked about what it was like 25 years ago, what it was like today. If you had to prognosticate right now, 25 years in the future, what does China look like specifically related to religion, but also since you made that connection a minute ago about how religious freedom and religion is very fundamental to a well-functioning democracy, what broader things do you see socially and politically happening in China as well?
Well, let me get to something that I describe as what Black Swan Theory. Black Swan Theory is something that dates back to the 17th century in the scientific community when they saw when something was considered impossible, said, well, that's as likely as a black swan. Then, lo and behold, explorers go to Australia and they discover a black swan. I've never seen one myself. I'm told they're not very good looking, unlike their white counterparts. But the thing is, they're genetically identical to their white counterparts, except basically they have black feathers instead of white feathers. And so now it's become something like, as a metaphor of the impossible, to something that is very unlikely and considered improbable, but could it actually happen? Now, China, in this case, is developing economically. There has never been a successful free market economy that hasn't eventually democratized. They either develop or they crack down and implode in, and usually they crack down in some form of fascist or totalitarian system, of which the Chinese Communist Party fits under.
Yeah.
And that's something you can't say. I mean, some people separate fascism and communism, but no, it's fascism is the methodology they use to control.
Right.
And the thing is, eventually, so China, when you say, look at China 25 years out, China's going to get to a point where they're going to either sacrifice their development and their capitalism under the normal theory, that they would actually then implode their economic development because they crack down. Because one of the things that people forget about when you start having economic development is people want to, once they start getting wealth, they want to have a guarantee that they're going to be able to keep it.
Keep it, and they want control over their lives.
Yes.
They want to be able to make their own decisions about the stuff and junk they have.
Yeah, and you take a look at that was what the lords were wanting when they forced the king to sign the Magna Carta.
Right.
They wanted a say, and you start getting this desire for the say in what is happening, and they want just and right laws, not arbitrary ones. And so this is where you get the religion and the rule of law that we were looking at, is the idea is, are they going to actually have the rule of law and do that and start doing it? But once you start doing that, then you're going to start opening the door for democracy. So is China, so the question that I bring up with that black swan is China going to be able to keep its development economically and not grant democracy? And if I were a betting man, I would bet that China's not going to be the black swan. That it's going to either have to go one way or the other. It's either going to implode its development by refusing to grant freedoms, or it's going to eventually have to say, start easing up, and they actually allow the freedoms that China 25 years from now is going to be a much freer nation than it was 25 years ago. And that is the direction. I mean, what Deng Xiaoping had to do, and his successors, is allow more freedom in order to get economic development. They're trying to limit it to the economic sphere, but they're also running into problems in the economic sphere. Is you need that rule of law, you need that. Intellectual property, copyright, all those things that are going there that all come within that thing. A contract is a contract. It's not who you know or which official you can bribe. It's the idea that there is a rule of law that if a company signs a contract with you, that if they one side or the other violates it, it can be taken to a court and it can be adjudicated according to the terms of the contract and fairness. That's where China's coming to it, and they're at the crux of it. And I think their entire prosperity is going to hinge on their decision. Where they will go with that, I don't know. I would hope for the sake of the Chinese that it will go in the direction of democracy and freedom. My fear is that it will go in the direction of repression. When it comes down to the religion, though, I believe no matter which way it goes, I think Christianity and religion in China is going to continue to expand and develop. I think that there's the innate human need to say that this is not all that is here, that just I'm not just born, I make some money, live comfortably, and die, that I want to, that there is a purpose out there, and that purpose is God. And God has shown me in my faith, Christianity, was through his word and his son Jesus.
Well, I think that is a good place to end this with. I think your optimistic prognostication is right on. I think that's what the attitudes that I share about where China's going. But since you're the Chinese expert, I defer to you on this. We'll check back with you in 25 years. Actually, we'll probably check back with you sooner than that and have you back on the show again, because there's a lot more stories that you have to tell us that you really haven't covered. But that is about our time for today. So, Kevin, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.